is the Freedom Fiends Variety Hour, broadcasting from Pod Bay Sit and Stay, 82 feet above sea level at Intergalactic K9 Studios. We loosen your leashes, unlatch those cage doors, and distract your handlers to keep the shock collar of statism from being clamped down around your neck. Can you feel it, Jeremy? Is it working?
I don't know if it's working, but I feel something.
As always, the Freedom Fiends is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. This allows reuse by anyone except governments and government agents. To learn more, go to BIPCOT.org. All right, we're back. It's early Monday morning, bright and early.
Yes, it is.
And I don't think I've been on for a whole week.
Wow.
Yeah. I understand how Michael kind of gets to be chomping at the bit sometimes when he hasn't been on for a while.
Yeah, I don't get that anymore. I do too many shows.
Yeah, I guess it's still new with me. So after a week, I'm excited to get back out on the radio and have a platform where we can actually, you know, spread liberty to the masses, or at least what think is the masses.
Well, I'm always excited for that part. It's just been, you know, as you and I were discussing beforehand, it's just been one of those weekends where I'm just kind of like, bleh. Well, there you go. I'm channeling my inner Michael. So he's, you know, he was going to join us tonight, but his voice is still a little off. So he's going to rest himself up some more. I'll try to pick up a slack for him and feel like the cranky old man tonight.
Yes. Stuff happens, but the show must go on.
Yes, it shall.
Sometimes I join you in the cranky old man club. But I've got my coffee going and haven't been on for a week, so I'm glad to be here. I'm looking forward to having another exciting show.
Yeah. I'm actually drinking coffee tonight. I rarely drink coffee before the show because I'm usually wired enough once it ends that I have a hard enough time falling asleep. And especially on nights like tonight when I have to get up, when I need to be, I'm really supposed to be up by like 9 o'clock at the absolute latest, which to some people doesn't sound like that bad. But, you know, when you're not getting to bed until 4 a.m. after you've finished the show and then edit it and everything and then wind down, it's pretty early. See, look at this. I said I wasn't going to filibuster in the first segment, and now I found stuff to talk about. normally on days like that, on Mondays like this, if my kids don't stay the extra night with me, I can sleep in. But I have an early morning visit I got to go do, and then I can come back home and hang out for a little while. Which by then I'll probably be wide awake by that point, so I won't be able to fall back to sleep. And then I have to head out to work again. And then I have a dinner, quote unquote, date tomorrow. It's not a romantic date, but I'm actually going to finally meet a fellow pet sitter who I've been friends with now for a couple of years, and we've passed business back and forth to each other, but we've never actually met in person. And she's one of the few people. Well, one of the few people on the island who actually still wanted to talk to me after everything that happened to me. we've been trying to get this done for months now. And we're finally going to sit down for dinner tomorrow night. And I'm going to try my best to convince her to purchase at least some of my company.
Right on.
So we'll see how that goes. Yes. Yeah. I am drawing ever closer to the end of Jay's Sit and Stay, and which is why I chuckled as you started reading the intro and you chose to read mine, because you're still the only other person who's read my intro besides me. But
we've got to use it while we can.
Exactly. We will have to retire that one in another month because it just won't make sense anymore. But yeah, it's drawing closer, man. It's going to be weird after a dozen years of doing can't say doing the same thing, because that was always one of the great things about my business, was it was never exactly the same thing every day. Even if I had the same basic schedule, it was always different because the weather changes, you know, dogs do different things on different days. And it was always, not always fun, but always interesting. And overall, good
experience. Never a dull moment when you're surrounded by dogs.
Yeah, this is true. Well, all sorts of animals, but yeah, especially when you're surrounded by dogs of all different shapes and sizes and ages, it's always interesting. So yeah, it's gonna be weird, but yeah. I'm looking forward to new adventures.
I too am drinking a coffee right now, and I can actually do so a lot more easily now because I moved my Monday shift to another day. So Amazon has a really neat thing set up where that you can customize your schedule, and they actually approved a schedule where I do three doubles, and I only have to go show up 3 days a week. So it's really nice. I have Mondays off now, and I can stay up late on Sunday and drink my coffee.
Nice.
And be on the fiends.
So. Now you're able to do all those like you even before you shifted to this, you were still able to do. I remember you telling me you were able to do like just you know you could kind of make your own schedule and do doubles. Is like the warehouse mm-hmm. open 24/7?
They are open 24/7.
Okay.
They're not always, I guess, palletizing and, you know, shipping out. There are shifts where they do what they call the sorts, like because it's a fulfillment center where I work and all the packages come in and on trucks and then we sort them and send them out on different trucks. But there is only, I think, between 3 o'clock and 7 o'clock in the morning, there is a shift there, but it's not like a normal operating shift. I think it's basically just they get everything switched over for the next day. And but then at 7 o'clock in the morning, they open up all the new trucks that came in, and then we start all over again.
So, gotcha.
Yeah.
But I guess it is possible for at least some people to work through the entire night, huh? Because that's
yeah. They do actually do certain things 24 hours, but our normal operations are only about 20 of the 24 hours.
Yeah, that's still a lot though. So that's cool. Yeah. That's yeah, definitely it leaves you lots of opportunity for work then if you have that many hours available.
Oh yeah.
So,
and that's just the particular location that I'm at. I know that other buildings, like even right next door to us, they have like I think 11 or 12 hour shifts that work back to back. So they do have like a 24 hour. They're constantly in operation 24 hours a day.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, for years I did different jobs. I did different overnight jobs, and although it's a schedule that takes a while to work into, I was always comfortable doing those shifts. I kind of like, probably because I've always been more of a night owl. So, you know, I never really minded when I was offered those shifts. It was either coming off of them was a pain in the butt, or if I actually wanted to have any semblance of a life, it could become difficult. Because, you know, most, unless you wanted to hang out with just the people who, other people who worked overnights, mm-hmm. you had to forego sleep in order, you know, you had to sleep. I used to have to sleep in like weird shifts. I think the last time I did that was when I worked at the animal hospital right before I started my company. And, you know, I would hang out with some of the people that I worked the overnights with. You know, you get off work 7 o'clock in the morning and you go out to breakfast together. Well, it's dinner for you at that point, but, you know, you basically go out for breakfast afterwards and hang out for a little while. And then some people go home and sleep, and like me, I go home and crash for a couple hours and then have to wake up because, you know, not only if you want to have to have a life, but if you want to do anything, especially if you have to do anything related to government, you know, there's only certain hours during the day that you're allowed to do that because they're only open for certain hours. And depending mm-hmm. on which agency you have to deal with, sometimes they're open, they have like the craziest hours. Like the worst is always whenever I had to deal with the town, like the town that I live in, the township.
Right.
Their offices, they're open from like 8 to 5 every day, but most departments, especially the ones that seemingly I always needed to be in touch with, like have like the weirdest hours. Like you can only call the people from like 9 a.m. to like 10:30, and then they're not available the rest of the day, even though they're there getting paid. I don't know what they're doing, but you have like an hour and a half window to call them. So it's like, now you get home at like 8:30. It's like, now I got to stay up for another hour so I can sit on hold for an hour to finally get through to these idiots.
That reminds me of the office at my old apartment complex. I used to work like 8 to 4, 8 to 5 pretty much. And they were only open from like 9 to 4. And so I'd have to, you know, take my lunch break to deal with them if I had to go into the office, because anytime outside of work, they were closed.
Yeah. So it becomes, you know, it's one of those things. If you're somebody who works a 9 to 5, it becomes very difficult to take, you know, unless you're lucky enough to have a job where you're allowed to make phone calls during the day, it can be very difficult to do stuff. Or if you work overnights, it becomes very difficult to do that stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I got used to for so long running on split shifts of sleep. you know, where, like I said, I come home, make a couple of phone calls, and then try to pass out for like 2 or 3 hours, and then force myself to get up, and then go out and do other things, and then come home and take another nap.
And,
you know, so, yeah, that's...
Yeah, so I'm really thankful that Amazon has such a flexible schedule like that, and they just recently approved my new schedule just in time for AnarchCon, because if I was going to have to work the Monday following AnarchCon, I was going to have to take a day off, but they approved my new schedule, so I didn't even have to do that. So I'm really excited. Next weekend, actually next Sunday, I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be at AnarchCon in Virginia. So I'm looking forward to that. You might have to do this show all by yourself next week.
Yeah, my Michael, if when you listen to this, you better be prepared to come back next week, man, because I don't think I'm up for doing a solo show just yet.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure I could find something to filibuster about for a while, but you know.
You sort of did a solo show, like one of your first shows, I think, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, that was only a little while though.
Yeah. It was like a few segments.
Yeah. Doing a whole one, you know. I mean everybody knows I can talk. I mean, heck, I do my own solo podcast from time to time, and I could do 45 minutes sometimes an hour, but
you know, that's impressive.
I like having people here with me. It's much. You know, and nobody wants to listen to me yak for that long on the radio anyway.
I don't know that I could keep myself focused enough for a 45-minute rant to stay on the subject.
Oh well, you know, there's being able to do it for 45 minutes and then staying on the subject. You know, sometimes those are mutually exclusive, Shane.
That's true. I'm the type of person that gets off topic really easily.
Yeah. Oh well. Then you fit. Well, that's why you fit in so well around here. I mean, come on, our fearless leader is the one man the only person I've ever met who can interrupt himself multiple times during the same conversation.
Oh. Yeah,
and still manage to bring it all back by the end. I haven't gotten that good yet. I've tried. I caught myself doing that.
That's definitely a knack.
Yeah, I've caught myself doing that recently on the Seeds of Liberty podcast, where we'll start. We'll drift off, and then I have it in my head. I'm like, we need to get back to this.
Now, I could probably interrupt myself, but would I remember where I left off afterwards? I don't know.
Well, we'll try to figure out the answer to that question during the break, and we'll see what we got when we come back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
And we're back. And, last segment we were talking all about changes in schedules and, you know, staying up on weird hours and stuff like that. But I guess we do have a few stories tonight. I guess we can get to some of those. And the first one I guess we could cover, and this one only because this got messaged to me like by multiple people tonight, and then I saw a bunch of people posting it, so I guess this apparently just broke recently, but there's a story from the AP that claims that our dear leader, good old Trumpykins, is getting prepared to fulfill one of those promises he made to the police a while back, that he's going to lift the bans on military gear going to the police, which can only end badly for people, unfortunately. But the police departments across the country getting quote unquote surplus gear from the military has been something that's been going on, I think, since the 90s. I think that's when it started up. I think that might have been a Clinton thing that kind of ramped that up. And, you know, it becoming increasingly more evident, obviously, as more and more people were able to tell, like, you know, that the term the militarization of the police has become kind of common parlance for well over a decade at this point. And, you know, because you can see it. It's kind of hard to ignore it, you know, even in your own towns, you know, when you get little towns all over the country and sometimes almost in the middle of nowhere being given MRAPs, you know, those armored vehicles and yeah. stuff like that. But one of the few good things the last resident of the awful office, good old Obama, did was actually try to put a stop to this. By placing bans on certain military equipment, although the equipment that he actually had to ban was really mind-blowing. I remember first reading about this when it happened and then kind of forgetting about it. And then this article brought it back to me because the stuff that had to be banned, because up until this point, it was perfectly okay for police departments to receive it, were grenade launchers.
Yeah, I know, right?
Along with the bulletproof vests and riot shields and other and it, now it says firearms and ammunition, but if you read deeper into it, the stuff Obama had to ban, because again it was perfectly fine for them to do it, was not just ammunition but 50 cal and higher ammunition.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine that you would need anything bigger than 50 caliber. But like even 50 caliber is overkill.
That's one
in most
big
cases.
Bullet. Yeah. And you know just the fact that police were able to have that stuff to begin with is insane. Like it would have been perfectly fine if the military had just handed over this stuff to them, you know. And the grenade launchers, like in what situation has a police department ever needed a grenade launcher? You know, I mean, like, I thought the MRAPs and stuff were bad, but, like, grenade launchers, really? You had to ban that? Like, that just means that either someone had them or people were filling out forms trying to acquire them. That, like, it had to happen enough to finally be like, no, we can't allow this anymore. You know, like, that's not something you just willy-nilly pick off the top of your head and go, ah, yeah, you know, grenade launchers, those are, you know, we're going to ban those. If nobody was using them or nobody was acquiring them or attempting to acquire them, why would you even bring it up? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, I don't. I did read the article, but I don't recall whether they actually did have them already or not. But
yeah, no, it doesn't mention it. Just like I said, it was just the fact that had to be part of when Obama back in 2015, when he actually tried to put this ban in place. You know, that's what it was. And according to the article, like a bunch of stuff had been taken back. Where was it? I think I lost the part. There was a bunch of stuff that there was a department in charge. There was a department put in charge of this, which of course is a double-edged sword, because anytime a department is put in charge of, you know, collecting these items, you can rest assured that there's a good chance the department was created in order to do this. An existing department was given a whole bunch more money to expand themselves, to hire more people, because that's just how government works, you know. Now you won't find those details in this story, because this just comes off the AP, which they're not known for their, you know, deep investigative journalism or willingness to bash the government openly about their practices. You know, they do toe the line. They do toe the line to a certain extent. So you wouldn't expect to find that there, but it, you know. Well, the music's rolling in, so we're going to go to the market, and we'll have to come back and talk more about this. But yeah, like I said to start, giving more firepower to the police, never a good thing for the plebs.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof. My fellow sheep. Election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues.
No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CatMuff, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CatMuff. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Well, woof.
Freedom beam. And we're back. I'm Jeremy here tonight with Shane.
Hello.
Hello. And in the last segment, we were talking about good old Trumpykins and fulfilling his promises, trying to fulfill his promises to give the police even more firepower to oppress us. I mean, keep us safe from terrorists and such. But I do want to start off with first. I'll start off with a quick. I was wrong, and I was just wrong in the last segment. I want to quickly correct that. I mentioned that the whole giving surplus military gear and stuff to the police, including apparently grenade launchers. I said originally started in the 90s, and I just assumed it. I just offhandedly assumed it started under Clinton, but as I reread the article quickly to try to find some other information, I noticed the date 1990, and that's actually when that act of Congress came down. So that was actually at the hands of good old Daddy Bush, Herbert Walker, and so yeah, nice. That actually makes even more sense. That's you know. The good old Republicans, law and order people love to
the police to stay was their thing, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
More so than the Democrats.
Yeah, so that does make more sense. So yeah, I was wrong. Let's fix that. The original act of Congress went into effect in 1990, and then Obama tried to put a stop to at least some of it back in 2015, and now here we are a couple of years later, and Trump, after. I don't know. I guess it was a couple of months ago he gave that speech, maybe a month ago. I don't even remember now, where he gave that speech to one of the police unions where he did you where there was the one line that he said about, you know, talking about when they're putting suspects in the car that they don't they shouldn't be so nice to them, basically, you know, don't hold their heads. So, you know, basically implying, you know, if they smack their head as they're getting into the car, no big deal. Now he tried to like specify, like, you know, if they were murdering somebody, but like he just basically said, you know, suspects, and, you know, totally throwing the whole innocent until proven guilty thing out the window. Just like, yeah, if you grab somebody for, you know, what you think they've done, or even if it's, you know, even if it's a victimless crime, if you grab somebody for, you know, they're committing some crime, yeah, it's okay to rough them up a little bit. That's basically what he said. So in that same speech, he, I guess, reaffirmed one of his promises on the campaign trail where he had given to another police, I don't remember if it was a police union or something like that, something to do with the police, where he had gotten their support, you know, for the nomination by promising that he was going to write an executive order that would overturn Obama's executive order to put the ban in place, to give them full, you know, more access to all these weapons and you know, allegedly for defense purposes. But you know, like I said, that never seems to work out that way.
Oh yeah, those grenade launchers were defense.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I mean, when Obama actually did that, when he put the ban on it in 2015, it was in response to the backlash after the events in Ferguson, after the Michael Brown shooting. And, you know, that was one of those instances where, even though, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter thing that got involved, and there was a lot of BS going around with that, and, you know, the whole, you know, hands up, don't shoot, which kind of, I think, got proven to be pretty much complete and utter, you know, bull Schumer, you know, it was still, like, more people's eyes were opened to just how militarized the police had become. Because, you know, even, you know, you were able to see on all the live streams that were going on, even the peaceful protesters that were there, because there were people rioting and there were people, you know, but there was tons of actual peaceful protesters out there getting shot with tear gas and
even
rubber
the camera
bullets.
People and the journalists were shot.
Yeah. And like everybody, like the cops, like, you know, beyond full riot gear, just like completely armored to the armored to the teeth, you know, and, you know, more people got to see that. And there was a giant backlash about how, you know, despite the fact that there was a lot of, you know, bad actors down there doing bad things.
Oh, yeah. Rightfully there was a backlash.
Yeah, there was definitely, there police were definitely going well above and beyond against the people who had nothing to do with that. So, you know, that's why Obama went ahead and did that, you know, obviously for, you know, political gain, I'm sure. But it was a good move, you know, I think. It was a positive step as far as I'm concerned. If you're going to have any positive steps with government, yeah, let's not give them as many weapons to beat us with at some point. Right. You know, but here you go, Trump, you know, like I said, he made this promise to get the endorsement from these people originally, and he reiterated that in that speech he gave a month or two ago, and now here he is. Apparently this information got leaked out. It hasn't actually come out yet. There's a lot of assumption that Attorney General Sessions is going to get, he has a speech scheduled for Monday, tomorrow, well, today now, and there's a lot of talk that he's going to drop the little tidbit there in that speech, but this has been, you know, apparently there's been some stuff that's been seen by people, it's been leaked, and this is what's coming down the pike. And, you know, again, they claim it's going to be for, you know, safety reasons, you know, to make us safer. But even when you look at Trump's quotes and the quotes they have in this article from different people within the police organizations, I've seen this plenty of times before, it's all about, you know, officer safety, because that's their number one goal. It's not the safety of the public. I mean, heck, even the those nine silly people in black dresses who think they get to make the rules for everybody, even they've let everybody know that it's not the police's job to protect and serve. You know, that's pretty much been ruled.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like almost explicitly, pretty much explicitly in multiple rulings now that that's not their job.
They've ruled that they do not have to protect you.
Yes. Their job is what their name has become. It's law enforcement. That is why they're known as LEOs now. They're not, you know, they were supposed to originally be like, you know, peace officers. Well, those days are long gone. Yeah, if they ever really existed.
Policy enforcers.
Yes, exactly. That's what it is. That's what law enforcement means. That's exactly what they are. That's perfect, Shane. That's exactly what they are. They are policy enforcers. And, you know, they just, you know, they use their quote unquote discretion to make sure equality under the law never happens. And they don't punish each other when they do horrible things, but they make sure they punish every one of us for usually the slightest infractions, well, pretty much whichever one can net them the most amount of money. That's right. The ones that they focus on. That's why the national statistics for like robbery, you know, solving robberies and murders and rapes and all this other stuff is horribly low, while busting people for drugs or racking up traffic tickets, those are always really high across the board, pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. Equal justice under the law, except for cops. They're above the law.
Yeah. Well, it's not even just them, though. I mean, they, you know, because, you know, they give preferential treatment to, obviously, politicians. Celebrities get a pass a lot of the times. Anybody with a lot of money, they tend to get passes somehow, some way. But you or I, if we got busted with any of these things, you know, we'd probably be in a lot of deep doo-doo. And, you know, God forbid we were black on top of that, then it would be even worse.
Right. That is
so
true.
Yeah. So But so yeah, so giving them more firepower is just, it's not going to end well for us. And yeah, you know, I'd love to see. I mean, I'm sure there will be, but you know, you got to manage the mental gymnastics Trump supporters have to go through to defend actions like this. You know, at least the ones who claim not to be, you know, say the quote unquote anarchists and libertarians who all of a sudden were for Trump. I'd love to see them explain this away. Like, how is this a good thing? You know, even though he's quoted as saying stuff like, you know, this is, you know, to help the police prevent, you know, stop terrorists. Well, it's not the police job to stop terrorists. That's what the FBI was there for, first of all. So police aren't busting terrorist rings. The FBI bust the terrorist rings or the terrorist plots that they first set up. That's their job.
Well, the cops like to pretend we're terrorists. It's kind of like make-believe.
Yeah, which, you know, of course, the horrible irony of that is that if you look at the USSA's government's definition of terrorism, the police largely fit that definition.
Oh, absolutely.
And the military definitely fits that definition.
Right.
Because I think their definition is the use of force or threats and or threats to achieve political aims. What, if anything, is the military and the police doing but using force and threats to achieve political aims? As we just described, even those silly people in black dresses let you know that that's exactly what the police are there to do. They are there to achieve the aims of the politicians who write the laws that have no basis in morality and very little basis, for the most part, in any actual semblance of right or wrong in general. Yeah. You know, just, you know, it's all about the arbitrary whims of either a certain segment of the population or, you know, more often than not, the people in power to a certain extent. You know, those are the people that write the laws, and it's for them. It's for their benefit, not for ours. And, you know, as we were mentioning before, when it comes to, you know, whatever the laws are, the ones that are enforced most often are the ones that can net them the most extra cash on top of everything else they're already given through their budgets.
That's true. Revenue generation.
Yeah.
But now they've got even stronger and better tools and toys to do it with. So if you were to tell them, come back with a Bearcat or come back with an MRAP even, they just might.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's because the police keep feeding everybody this line of BS that they need these things. I mean, really quickly before we head into the break, they themselves say, even the article, they claim that they need these weapons and this stuff to ensure that officers aren't put in danger when responding to active shooter calls and terrorist attacks. Again,
you're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Are you sick of seeing peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
Well, woof, woof. And we're back. Spent the past couple of segments talking about the police and how Trump is set to give them back even more toys to wreak havoc on the general population at large. And we actually have another story that ties directly into that, possibly to show that they don't even need those toys to harass people and for what it seems like virtually no reason. So again, giving them even more weapons is a really bad idea. But this one, this story, the headline is 91-year-old detained after allegedly pointing stick at office. Yes, you heard that correctly. A 91-year-old man was allegedly pointing a stick at officers. And not only was he detained, he was put in handcuffs, and by two or I think three different eyewitness accounts, he had his arm jacked up behind him as far as it could go, and he was slammed into the side of the police vehicle in order to be detained. A 91-year-old man. So this occurred in Memphis, Tennessee, South Memphis. And apparently the police were out looking for a suspect in another alleged crime, a woman, by the way, when they encountered this old man who just happened to be walking through. And according to one of the eyewitnesses, because the police obviously are not releasing any information because they have an ongoing investigation into this. But according to one of the eyewitnesses, and all three of the eyewitnesses they had in the video for the story, their stories seemed to line up pretty much exactly. But one of them claimed that, you know, the cops asked him what he was doing with this stick, to which the old man responded, "I'm old. I need this stick." And when he said, "I need this stick," he held it up to show them that it was just this, like a walking stick, essentially.
Right.
They took this as a threat from a 91-year-old man and proceeded to grab him and slam him into the car. And according to one of the other witnesses, quote, "put his arm all the way up here to the back of his back." So, you know, grabbing it and basically twisting the wrist as far as it can go up and behind him to make sure that he is secured and not going to injure them again, you know, because officer safety is paramount.
I'm sure they feared for their lives.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the guy actually told the news station that was reporting this that, you know, he uses the stick to fend off dogs in the neighborhood, but he was never, you know, he never threatened. Oh no, sorry, that wasn't him. It was one of the witnesses. That's because they know the guy. They said that's what he uses it for. But he never threatened them. All he did was show them the stick. And well, I mean, I know all too well how people react to certain things when you're just showing them something, you know, versus actually threatening them with it. I may know a little something about that. But I mean, I think this just goes to show that. And of course, you know, you get the naysayers who will claim that, you know, just the bad apples, or even worse in this situation, there's got to be more to the story. Well, I'm sorry. I have a hard time believing that there's any more to this story that makes it okay, you know, that justifies the actions of these officers. That, you know, three different eyewitnesses can all line up their, you know, all their facts seem to line up with this, and the police are very tight mouthed about everything because of course they have this ongoing investigation. But you know, they have to wait to release the body cam evidence that allegedly that was there. I mean, now of course, I wouldn't be surprised if when that time comes, we find out that oops, the cameras weren't turned on, or oh, they just happened to malfunction at that point, which does seem to happen quite frequently. I don't know if you've noticed that, Shane.
Right, I have. And this man is about my grandfather's age, and my grandpa has to use a cane when he walks. And a lot of times I will go like hiking with my grandpa, and he uses a walking stick just like the one that the man had. And they showed it in the video. It looks just like my grandpa's walking stick.
Yeah. And, so, like, again, this is, you know, you want to give these folks even more weapons, you know, giving them back the grenade launchers and 50 caliber plus ammo, you know, when they're grabbing old men for showing them a stick and roughing them up, as one of the other witnesses says, like he was some young thug, you know, it's, you know, these guys already fear for their lives all the time. Why give them bigger toys to play with? More people are going to end up dead that way. Anyway, we're headed off to the break. We'll be back in the next hour. Arms.
Are you tired of stinky socialists trying to take over America?
And are you also tired of theorists talking about the free market as a cure-all for every problem with no firsthand experience of how the market actually works?
Well, the Truth Justice American Way app gives you wall-to-wall shows by hosts who not only understand the market, but tell you how they make money in a variety of patriotic endeavors.
The Truth Justice American Way app for Android is 24/7 streaming audio content on the topics of finance, liberty, self-defense, and technology.
All the hosts are all-American Americans from all over America.
And the app is made in Wyoming, the cowboy state.
Because you should buy American, even with free Android apps.
Truth Justice American Way. Useful information, compelling personalities, and superior American audio quality.
Go on the Google Play Store or the Amazon App Store and search Truth Justice American Way.
God bless each and every one of you, and God bless America.
This is the Freedom Beans, broadcasting through Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza, on the artificial satellite Lib Pair 2017, in the Alpha Centauri region. As always, the Freedom Beans is covered by BIPCOT, no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org.
Worms.
So we are back for the second hour. I am Jeremy, joined tonight by Shane. What's going on, man? How you doing?
Doing pretty good. I think we are joined again by Sundance, aren't we?
Yes.
At least
yes.
In the second hour. Yeah.
I don't know if we're still, I think we're still on break in Belfouche, but I think, yes, we are. We do get to still welcome Sundance in the second hour, so hopefully our break will be over in the other place soon. But any hoodle. So yeah, so in the first hour, we talked a lot about the continued militarization of the police and how good old Trumpykins wants to give them even more toys to make us even more miserable. Protect us from ourselves, apparently. In the second hour, I think we'll shift gears a little bit, and we have this one article that. I think you sent us this. You sent me this, right, Shane? From one of the Mises article.
Jeffrey Tucker. Yeah on Mises.
Yeah, our friend Jeffrey Tucker from writing in. I know one of your both of our favorite websites, FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education.
Mm-hmm.
And he recently wrote an article on a different side of Mises, and Mises, of course, being Ludwig von Mises, considered one of the one of the people on the forefront of Austrian. Well, you know, was way back when, but still, as far as Austrian economists go, he's still considered one of the tops, even though he was still a good little statist pretty much all the way through. But when it came to economics, this guy is worlds above many other people. And
this is written by Jeffrey Tucker, of all people, who I don't know if he actually knew Mises as well as he knew Rothbard, but hearing his stories about Rothbard firsthand was really quite a treat, actually, because I didn't realize, back in the day that Tucker was actually friends with Rothbard and they used to hang out together. So hearing some of those stories was really neat. And so I really love the way he wrote this about Mises, because it seems as if he actually knew him personally. I'm not sure if that's the case, but
yeah, I don't think Jeffrey's that old. he may have gotten to meet him. I don't know at a very young age, yeah. but he definitely writes really glowingly about him. But
he does.
So yeah, this is most people know Mises as the economist, and if you've read his stuff, it can be rather dry, but it's always, and it's filled with information. So there's a lot of stuff you may have to read a couple of times to really grasp what he's saying. But in this article, he's basically talking about this one particular speech, I guess, he gave way back in 1951. And it was a rather informal setting. So, Mises was a lot more loose than he normally was. And apparently this one woman, what was her name? I'm going to lose it. Bettina Bean Graves actually took the entire set of lectures he gave down shorthand. And after Mises' death, they finally got together and took all of the shorthand notes that this woman had taken and turned the entire thing into a book. Which is called The Free Market and Its Enemies, which is essentially basically a transcript of these lectures that Mises gave, where he was a lot looser and gave a whole different side of him that Tucker seemed to really love. And I had actually never heard of this one, but apparently the way Tucker puts it is even most Misesians, I think that's how you pronounce that, aren't even aware that this thing exists.
I too was trying to figure out how to pronounce that word, because I figured, Mises is, I'm probably saying that right, but then when he coined that new word, Misesian or whatever, I don't know.
That's probably more accurate, Misesian, that would probably, because it is Mises, so. I've seen that written before, though. I don't know if he's actually coined that. Maybe he was the one who done, but that I've seen people use that before. Same thing.
The first time I've ever seen that particular word written that way.
Well, have you ever seen people referred to as Rothbardians?
Yes, I've seen many times.
Yeah, same type of thing. Whatchamacallit. So back to the article. What Tucker's referring to is the fact that, if you read Mises' stuff, you're obviously going to learn a lot. But he said, reading these lectures, it was just filled more with opinions and sometimes short but very powerful insights, versus just sometimes very technical stuff, because Mises' stuff, especially Human Action, which to this day I still haven't gotten through, because it's not exactly an easy read, and it is rather lengthy. But that's just the way he wrote. He was a very technical guy, and he knew this stuff inside and out, and wrote volumes upon volumes about economics and, not just about Austrian economics, but like the problems with other economic systems. One of his more famous books, I think, is just simply titled Socialism, where he just basically shreds socialism through the entire thing and does it very well. But, it's not exactly, it may not be a fun read, as opposed to this particular one that this other book that was put together. And, there's this one passage in particular from Tucker. So reading from the article, rereading this book over the last year, I've been absolutely astonished by the insights. They appear every few pages. Many points are here that you do not find in his writings, simply because the setting in which he spoke was more casual, so that he was able to explore a greater range of his thought. I am deeply grateful for so much of this book, but I want to mention one insight in particular that rocked my world so hard that I am still drawing on it. He is discussing the reaction of the discovery of economics and the freeing of society from authoritarian control. He notes that the first reaction came from the nobles, elites, and ruling classes who resisted the rise of the middle class. Gee, go figure. He then plunges straight into the influence of George F. Hegel. Mises tosses off an insight that shakes up everything. Here is the mic drop moment. So, and here's a quote from Mises. George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the famous German philosopher, gave rise to two schools, the left Hegelians and the right Hegelians. Karl Marx was the most important of the left Hegelians. The Nazis came from the right Hegelians. And obviously, as Tucker said, he was blown away by this insight, and obviously I had never thought of that either. So it, right away it's like, wow, that is pretty, when you think of it those terms.
Yeah, that is a very mic drop moment. And I'm also, the paragraph right before that, When I was reading this article, I actually kind of read it in Jeffrey's voice. I don't know if you did the same thing.
I read everything in Jeffrey's voice. I just can't do Jeffrey's voice. So I thought about trying to do it at the beginning. I was like, nah, I'm no Jim Jesus. I can't pull that off. So
exactly. I had the same thought. And then I also thought the same thing. I couldn't pull it off like Jim Jesus could do.
Yeah, he's got that tuckered up hat. But, you know, I mean, having met Jeffrey now twice, and just having listened to plenty of his talks and stuff like that, I do anytime anything by him, you have to read it in his voice, because it just, you know, how
but he is right about that. The left Hegelians and the right Hegelians, it's just two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's one of those things that, you know, like Tucker said, there's a lot of stuff more like that in this little book, which I will link this article in the show notes, so others can check it out if they want to. I'm definitely going to have to add that to my list of my ever-growing list of things to read. But right. I would definitely, because, you know, like I said, Mises can be difficult to read sometimes. But I've read a lot of his smaller stuff, and like a lot of his articles and some of his smaller books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I always learn things, but I would definitely be interested to read even more when he's basically looser like this, and right. he's not just being technical and going from point to point and just demolishing point after point, which is great. You know, it was mm-hmm. well needed, and still a lot of his stuff still holds up all these years later, obviously. And you know, I think it's very important. But to kind of see this different side of him. You know, mm-hmm. I can. It would definitely be interesting to me. So I'm gonna have to check it out.
Yeah, and another thing too about Hegel and the Hegelians. I don't know if our audience is familiar with something called the Hegelian dialectic, which is the classic problem reaction solution that is so commonly discussed among conspiracy circles. But that was Hegel, and it does appear to be the strategy of both the far left and the far right. This whole divide and conquer thing is just another form of problem reaction solution, which Mises so brilliantly, you know, put and concisely stated in that one quote.
Yes. Yeah, it really does. I mean we've talked about it in the show before, and it's something that's become popular, I guess, popularized in the past, I don't know how long it's been now. I've only been hearing about it for the past few years or so, but the horseshoe theory of politics, which that plays into it too, where it's just, you know, on either side, you know, the further people think they get away from each other, the closer they're actually getting, because you end up using a lot of the same tactics. You know, and you know, when it comes to, like, you know, the Hegelians, for instance, you know, as Mises points out again from the article, which is coming directly from this book, but you know, the split with the left and the right, you know, the only real difference is that the right believed that history was driving towards a culminating moment in which all final authority on earth was embodied by the Prussian state and church. Gee, where is that? That sounds familiar. I can't imagine where I've heard that before. But we're gonna head into the break, so we'll have to get back to this once we return.
Worms.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Well, well. And we're back. And in the last segment, we were talking about this article from Fee, written by good old Jeffrey Tucker, about the different side of Ludwig von Mises. And right before the break, I got myself cut off, but I was trying to read through the differences, as Mises saw it, between the two sides of the Hegel camp, which when you look at it through this lens, you can actually see how most of the current left and right, especially here in the United States, sees things, and they both do seem to fall. They both do seem to fall under the under. You know, a lot of them seem to fall under this category. So to pick up where I left off, you know, the right side, according to Mises, believe history was driving towards a culminating moment, which all final authority on earth was embodied by the Prussian state and church. And the left believed that the culminating moment was more universal and was characterized by the birth of a new man who would live completely differently from anyone else in history. And so the people, the right Hegelians, basically became the fascists and the corporate theocratic conservatives, which we see running rampant on the right in the United States today and have been for a very long time, because they've had very, you know, actually both sides have had very fascist tendencies. Of course, they, you know, you got the, they got the progressives on the left who pretty much worshipped the fascist model. You know, FDR is quoted many times of being very, you know, loving what good old Mussolini was doing over there, and also there was also a lot of admiration for things Hitler was doing before he started killing people, and then they had to say, oh, I guess we can't back him too much anymore. But you know, lots of fascist tendencies, and of course the left side, you know, following the left followed socialism straight through Marx and beyond, which is exactly what they did. They latched onto that, and that has become has exploded in so many different directions, you know, so many different forms of socialism, allegedly. And then spread further.
Leninism, communism. Stalinism, yeah. Maoism.
Exactly. And you can see, you can see how that's turned out through history. Right. How that's worked out for people. So basically, neither side of the Hegelians has really been good for humanity. you either got the fascists who are outright killing people, or you got the socialists and the communists who end up starving everybody to death by trying to make everybody equally poor. So I guess they would actually be the more successful ones, right?
I guess if that was their actual intent and not really an unintended consequence.
Well, you know, they want to make everybody equal, and you can't make everybody equally wealthy unless you make everybody equally, you know, is everybody equally poor.
But I don't think they actually understood that until they experienced it themselves.
Well, you would hope not. If they kept pressing forward even knowing that was going to happen, that'd be even worse.
Right. But, yeah.
You know, plenty of regimes since then, I think, have done it knowing what will happen to their people. It's just a matter of, you know, if you're going to have some kind of state socialism or state communism, well, the people in charge, for the most part, usually end up doing well, you know. Mm-hmm. Even, I mean, obviously not everybody, because, you know, even in the good old USSR, you know, it was only the people at the top that, you know, were well off. The rest of the government workers, and even the lower level higher ups, were pretty miserable when things started crumbling down horribly. And the black market had to come in to rescue them, because otherwise a lot more people would have died.
You'll have that.
What's that?
You'll have that, where the black market has to come in and rescue, you know, act like a social safety net in a lot of cases.
Well, yeah, because what, you know, and that's, and of course people don't, well, a lot of people either don't know about that or don't realize it or don't want to talk about that, because that right. just, you know, that's one of those situations that kind of proves that the voluntary interactions of human beings can do a lot more than the forced central planning of any type of government. Because look what has to save it,
right?
when the government finally becomes too bloated and everything begins to go haywire.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention a lot of these socialist and communist countries, the economy actually gets by with a lot of help from the black market, which actually props these economies up more so than it would if it didn't exist.
Well, yeah, it did take longer for communism to finally, it's back again to a large extent, but to die to the extent that it had been when the USSR broke up, it was prolonged by the black market. But you know, the upside of that is more people lived.
Right, exactly.
You know, it definitely could have had a much swifter death, but it would have involved probably millions more people with that. So I guess in that instance, I'll take the prolonging. You know, seems right. like the better deal. Worms.
listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's Antiwar.com.
And we're back. I'm still Jeremy. That's still Shane.
Hello.
And for something a little different, we have something positive that a particular government may actually be doing, although it's going to be at the behest of the people. And unfortunately, this particular government has smacked down the behest of the people in the past before, as I recall. But California has a proposed ballot measure that could decriminalize magic mushrooms. Well, they use hallucinogenic mushrooms in the title, but I like the term magic mushrooms. They're really good ones. And so, yeah, there's, this is, I don't think this has been done anywhere else except, well, actually, that's not true. Oregon just decriminalized a bunch of stuff. I don't remember if mushrooms was involved.
Was that in there? I don't know, but I'll have to check.
Well, they did decriminalize certain things. I don't remember if mushrooms were or not. If not, California might be the first to do this. But it's being done on the basis, well, at least since it's a ballot measure, that usually means enough people are trying to get this pushed through. And I think they need something like 350-something thousand signatures.
Yeah, 365,000.
There you go, to get it on the statewide ballot. And, like I said, unfortunately, in the past, they've had ballot measures that have, passed. And then the government has just been like, nah, sorry, we decided we're not going to let that happen, which kind of seems antithetical to the system if it was supposed to work like they claim it is. But anyway, this is, the push for this is actually being started by a guy who's running for mayor in the town of Marina, which is kind of cool, as far as politicians or would-be politicians go. But if he's doing it because, according to him, using magic mushrooms helped him get off of heroin 15 years ago. And I know there's been some, I know there's a lot of research that's been going into that. Is it MAPS? Is that the organization that does a lot?
Yeah, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Yes. MAPS. Yeah, they do a lot of research into this, and it's been coming up. If I remember correctly, was it people suffering from PTSD? I know MDMA is used for that, but I could have swore I read something earlier this year about them using shrooms for that too.
Well, shrooms for PTSD and depression as well.
Oh yeah, there you go. Thank you. Yeah, so. This is another thing where it's, right now it's considered a Schedule I drug, which, according to the government, Schedule I means it has no medicinal benefit whatsoever, which is just poppycock. Obviously, if it's being, it's same thing for a lot of these other drugs, because I'm pretty sure MDMA is on that list, too. Another one being used for things like PTSD and depression and stuff like that. And a lot of, these are being used successfully right now to help people with certain things. And as this guy who's running for mayor can attest to, I've seen this too, that it's all, that it is being used for people to get off different drugs like that and stuff like that too.
Oh yeah, as well as alcohol.
Yeah. So, if all these people are using it to, get themselves off certain things or get them over certain issues that they're having, then I don't know about you, Shane, but that seems to me like some kind of medicinal benefit, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's no reason that it should be Schedule I, because there's obvious medicinal benefits, especially when it comes to cannabis, which is also Schedule I. There's been so many studies that prove that it has not just various medicinal benefits when it comes to like glaucoma and things, but actual cancer fighting abilities.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this is coming on the heels where they, you know, last year, yeah, I guess almost a year ago now, yeah, so last November, California, you know, they finally voted in to legalize recreational marijuana after, you know, medical's been there for a while. They were the first state to have medical, right?
California has probably been the very first state to do it multiple times, but then they've had to kind of fight with the federal government over that. So you'd have, like, back in the 90s, I think, California legalized medicinal marijuana, and the first dispensaries popped up, but then the federal government sent in the stormtroopers and shut them down. And I think that happened the first couple times that California tried to do it. So then they stopped trying, and then other states, you know, during the Obama administration started getting away with it, and then, you saw... You know, Colorado, Washington, Alaska, you know, all follow in their footsteps.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. Now that's coming back to me. Yeah, I was pretty sure they did have it at one point, but yeah, they had to bring it back. But of course,
yeah, they had it a couple times during the 90s.
Yeah, and now, of course, you know, talking about the federal government, you know, we mentioned him in the first hour, you know, good old Jeffy Sessions. If he has his way, he's going to keep shutting stuff like this down. You know, right. So the fact that California has legalized it again,
right?
It may not last that, you know, we'll see how long it lasts this time. Well,
maybe the third time's a charm.
Yeah, hopefully. At least for the people there, their sake. I mean, of course, as I know I've discussed on this show before, I definitely prefer decriminalization over legalization. But, you know, which this step, the as far as the mushrooms seem to go, that seems to be the route they're trying to go with that versus the legalization.
I was surprised to actually see them say decriminalization.
Yeah, that's
definitely the right way to go.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, as you know. And,
I mean, they are just mushrooms, after all.
Yeah, right, man. They just grow in nature, man. I mean, come on, they grow on cow poop. Let people eat them if they want. but yeah, when it comes to the whole legalization versus decriminalization debate, for me, the easiest thing to always point to is Portugal, and just say, "See, look what happens when you could do that stuff." Because they're now going on over 15 years of the decriminalization of most drugs, I think pretty much all of them, and all of their numbers are now like there was a spike in usage during the first couple of years, which completely makes sense, because if you have something that's been prohibited for however long and you have a certain amount of people who would be willing to try it but are fearful of the legal consequences and therefore won't go out of their way to try these things because they don't want to risk getting caught, once it becomes, you know, available for use for everybody and you know there's no longer a danger of being arrested for, you know, using it or trying to purchase it or stuff like that, of course it makes sense that more people would try it to see what all the fuss is about, basically, or just to be, oh, I can finally try this thing and now I'll try it. And of course, the people who oppose measures such as this always bring up ideas like that and say, oh, you know, everybody will just start using them. But Portugal has been a great example of no, that's not the case. Plenty of people tried it out to start with, and then as the years went on, those numbers, the usage numbers dwindled. The overdose numbers dropped off the map. And, you know, and why is that? Because, well, people got a taste of it. You know, like I said, a lot of people who may not have tried it beforehand because of the threat of legal consequences, now we're like, oh, I'll try it out. And guess what? They figured out it wasn't for them. Oh no, you know, especially when that comes to cannabis. Oh no, that throws that whole, you know, gateway drug thing right out the window now, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. That all these people tried it and then said, whatever. You know, now I can say I've tried it. Now I'll move on. You know, so like I said, the usage numbers went down. Addiction rates are way down. Overdose rates are way down because now that it's decriminalized, you don't have to be, you know, it's not in the black market anymore necessarily. It's more in like a gray market where it's less dangerous. And, you know, less people have to turn to the crazier designer drugs that get made because certain things are illegal. You know, like here, you know, everybody likes to talk about the meth problem. Well, why is there a meth problem? As I think it might have been on one of our shows a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned, you know, meth, all meth is this era's bathtub gin, you know. That's all it really is. The reason it's so rampant is because of drug prohibition, and because the government cracks down on certain drugs and makes it harder for people to acquire those drugs. Well, or because of the more heightened risk involved because government's cracking down at it. Prices get raised on other drugs. People can't afford that, so they look for cheaper solutions. Well, that's where meth comes in, and that's why meth has become so popular because it's pretty cheap to make. It's actually very cheap to make. If you make really bad, you can make really crappy stuff that'll still get you high. Apparently, I don't know. I've never tried meth, but from what I've learned, even the 60-70% pure stuff will still get you messed up. So even a cheap, badly made batch will get you high. So that becomes rampant, just like bathtub gin became rampant during alcohol prohibition. Because okay, you ban this stuff, you make it harder for people to acquire stuff. They're going to start making their own. They're going to find ways to get high. They're going to find ways to get drunk. They're going to find ways to medicate themselves. So that's why you have the problem like that. And then you run into the risk of, again, when you're in that more dangerous environment, you deal with shadier and shadier individuals. So the risk of people cutting the drugs with dangerous stuff in order to turn more of a profit to outdo their competitors and stuff like that becomes higher in those situations. But when you decriminalize it, and when things are decriminalized, then you can open up a shop. You could have an above the board store that sells these things. And you know what you could have right next to that? You could have a store that tests these substances
exactly.
for their purity levels. And people, I know plenty of people. I mean, I know myself, if I was going to partake in certain drugs, I would love to be able to have it purity tested. And I would be more than happy to pay a fee for that.
Yeah, in situations like that, you end up having higher purity, higher quality and lower cost.
Exactly. And so everybody benefits. And like I said, Portugal now has become, to me, a shining example of this. I mean, yeah, there's still like certain levels if you happen to get caught with like a huge amount of drugs, they can still throw your butt in jail for it. But this is government we're talking about. But still, overall, like you can see the numbers just keep to, the numbers, like I said, the overdose numbers, the addiction numbers, all these things just keep dropping and dropping and dropping. The further that you get away from the decriminalization. So I am all for this. I hope the people of California manage to get this on the ballot. And I'd love to see it pass because this is one of those models I'd love to see extended further out for more freedom in our lifetime.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.
Shane, and he's still Jeremy.
That's me.
And we're got a little bit of redemption in the third act. We don't always have that, but it is late night on GCN, and I like to talk about weird and mysterious subjects sometimes. And what's more weird and mysterious than mushrooms? Well, I did come across an article which is more of a video, but it's about a man from Michigan who has discovered how to move and lift 20-ton blocks of stone by hand using only wood, pebbles, counterweights, and manpower. He creates a compelling argument for methods used in the construction of Stonehenge, the pyramids, etc. And it has about a 6-minute video. And this was found on alternativemediasyndicate.org. The headline is, "For Forgotten Technology, Man Lifts 20-Ton Block by Hand." And I did watch the video, and he really does what it says. He uses a lot of wood, like planks and things, as he stacks these, well, he uses pebbles to rotate these large blocks, and then he uses wooden planks to put underneath them, and then he uses counterweights to tilt them and stack more blocks, and as he rocks these things back and forth and stacks more wood underneath, he can raise them up. And then as he raises them up high enough, he can start to use counterweights to tilt them. And he tilts them onto like a bed of sand that he has prepared. Once he gets it dropped down at an angle onto this bed of sand, then he uses the water to wash away the sand and drop the block into place. And he's built his own, like, you know, Stonehenge type creations. But then, you know, he's been working with bigger and bigger stones over time. And this video was showing him moving a 20-ton block, a very long 20-ton block, lengthwise up and down, perpendicular. And it's a really neat feat to see how he moves everything, you know, starting with these little pebbles and then wooden planks, and then he uses the counterweights and finally the sand. And it also shows in the video how he moved other structures, like I think a pole barn. He moved like a pole barn 300 feet onto another property using his rotation techniques. But it's all done with, you know, pebbles, planks, counterweights, and it's really just leverage is all it is. You know, he can do this by hand. And aside from moving the barn, he pretty much did all this stuff completely by himself. So if he did those things completely with one person, imagine what you could do if you had a whole team of, like, say, thousands. So these could be the type of techniques that were used to create the pyramids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I got to catch the video during the last break. I mean, I watched it on a fast speed to fit it all in, because you told me about this one after we started the show. But yeah, the pebble thing was the most fascinating to me. I mean, obviously the whole thing, just watching it and seeing like him launching that, you know, 20,000-pound stone straight into the air and getting it like perfectly level too by like you described, just washing that sand away. That was insane, and just letting the stone, you know, carry itself over like that. But the pebble thing was crazy. Like, he shows, like, he's got this whole setup with the, you know, the whole lever system with the pieces of wood that he's got, but he just lifts it up on one side and puts this little pebble underneath it, and by doing that he can spin the entire thing around.
Yeah.
The one point I saw him spin it, like, he did a 360-degree rotation with a zero turning radius. Because he ended up in the exact same spot, didn't move it at all. Like, that's insane. Like, this giant block. He's just this old, you know, this guy, you know, and he's an older guy, probably, what, like, in his, you know, 40s, maybe 50, actually 50s,
I would
probably
guess 50s, yeah.
50s, you know, looks like he's a little bit over, you know, not like a huge strapping guy either, but just by using these methods, he's able to push. And through most of the video, like you said, there's a couple things that he had help with, but for the most part, it's just him.
Right.
And just using his leverage.
He had to have a little help moving the barn, but you can understand. But it was based on the same principles as the pebble. And like you said, he can do a zero turn radius on a single pebble, and he uses a pair of pebbles to actually walk an object. That's how he was able to move, you know, things very long distances.
Yeah, so, I mean, unfortunately, this might blow a hole in a lot of, well, I'm sure they'll find other explanations for it, but for a lot of conspiracy theorists who think things like Stonehenge had to have been built by aliens and stuff like that. Well,
maybe not.
If this guy in the 21st century can figure all this out, you know, just using wood and pebbles, there's a chance, just a chance, that people before him figured it out too.
Worms.
But this is it's been a fun show, Cheyenne. Thank you for joining me tonight. Thank you, everybody.
Great as always.
Yes, thank you, everybody, as always, for listening. And for more of us, Go to freedombeans.com. Worms.
Worms.